Okay, the next part of our program is our call to action keynote, is what we're calling this. And I am very pleased that we have had the opportunity to have Tim Magner with us. Tim and I have known each other also, as with Karen, for many years. We're kind of part of the same club, the same clique. Tim brings to us today not only the voice of the U.S. Department of Education, but he also has extensive background in business as well as in education directly. So he's a wonderful hybrid of education, business, policy, and the school district level. And so we are quite thrilled to have Tim here. He is the director of the Office of Education Technology to give us our keynote call to action.
Well, I'm delighted to be able to be here with you today, and I hope you've had some excellent discussions. I've certainly enjoyed listening to all the conversations, and what Julie asked me to do was to try and put this in context, but also to try and give you, as she said, a little call to action, something to leave here with, the sort of the what are you going to do on Monday morning. So hopefully we'll be able to meet that tall order. So we heard today already that there's been a lot written about globalization, about the world is flat, et cetera, and that there's been a real consensus that education is the key to really transforming our ability to remain competitive. We also heard about student populations and about how in China and India, the number of students who are available to compete with our students are in fact huge. There's about 120 million kids in China and India in elementary school today, and we have about 50 million children in all of our education system. So we have a rate of change problem. We're not going to be able to catch up on volume, and so we have to compete on quality. We've also heard about technology and how technology is changing the way in which our students are interacting with each other, interacting with our economy, and interacting with each other. And although it wasn't mentioned, this is a site called Second Life, which you may have heard about, which is an immersive 3D virtual environment that students and others are getting involved in, both as a social networking construct, but also as ways of building new opportunities for interaction and engagement. And so I think one of the challenges that we have is that for our students who are experiencing Second Life, we're folks who are stuck in First Life. So the challenge is, how do we, as First Lifers, create an environment, an educational environment, that is attractive, engaging, and prepares students who have a Second Life context? So there's one thing worse than not being able to see: being able to see but having no vision. And yet, every man takes the limits of his own field of vision for the limits of the world. So we're in kind of a conundrum. As we heard today, we're educating students for jobs that don't exist, to solve problems that we don't yet know about, to use technologies that haven't yet been invented. And yet each of us comes with our own context, our own experiences. And so we're caught in a very critical transitional period. And yet we're seeing these transitions as well. In as late as 1996, there were about 140,000 of these payphones scattered all throughout London. And if you think about it, payphones make a whole lot of sense, right? You have a phone pretty much anywhere, and so wherever you want to go, more or less, there's an opportunity to make a phone call. So if with all of this telecommunications infrastructure spread liberally throughout our cities, there's really no reason for anybody to need a cell phone, right? And yet, my guess is everybody in this room probably has a cell phone, and as we saw earlier, they have annoying tendencies to go off, usually when I'm speaking. But so what is it about a cell phone? What is it that's different about a cell phone? Why are we willing to pay, you know, $40, $50 a month for this? Because a cell phone is a fundamentally different communications technology. When you call a cell phone, you call a person, not a place. My kids can dial the same 10 numbers and get me whether I'm in LA, whether I'm in Luxembourg, whether I'm in Lahore. And so the whole question of communication becomes very different. And yet it's not just voice communication. Well, there are about 187 million people in the US have a cell phone. But in Japan, they're using cell phones as electronic wallets to be able to pay for things with the SIM card in their phone. If we look at the kinds of things that people are doing today with cell phones, send and receive text messages, take pictures, play games, access the internet, etc., etc., there's a huge new ways of leveraging that communications infrastructure beyond just voice. And these are the percentage of people who want to do those things with their cell phone. Apparently a lot of people get lost because 47% of people want mobile maps. But if we think about, in 1975, the home media ecology, if we think about the products that were available, there were TV stations, news, advertising, generating a certain amount of content that came to your home over the airwaves or through mail. You had a few devices that you could use to display that on, and a few ways to store that information. And so the interaction map looks something like this. Today, however, you have a huge array of different types of producers, different ways of getting to your house, different ways of displaying it, different ways of storing it, so that our interaction map looks something more like this. In fact, the Consumer Electronics Association of America estimates that the average American home now has 26 different electronic devices for communication and media. Our home broadband penetration is approaching 50%, and yet that puts us 12th in broadband subscribers per 100 inhabitants in the world. If we look at internet access, it by age, it's pretty much flattening out as internet penetration becomes more and more ubiquitous. In fact, between 1999 and 2002, the largest group of new internet users was the children between the ages of 2 and 5. And the internet is having an impact on how we make our decisions. If you look at the numbers, these are numbers in millions of people who did fairly life-changing activities, buying a car, making a major investment, finding a place to live, changing jobs, etc. Fully half of those folks used the internet in some way as part of that transaction. And fully a third of those said it was important or crucial in making that decision. And in some cases, that was a significant increase since 2002, particularly when you look at major investment, helping others with illness, getting married. 60-70% increase in the number of people who said the internet was important or crucial in that decision. And it's not just accessing the information. It's finding advice and support. It's finding the ability to compare information. It's getting access to professionals. It's getting access to other people. It's being able to use an entirely different kind of information landscape to make decisions. We're now more connected in more ways to more people and more information than ever before. And our students are even more so. 40% of 12 to 14-year-olds have a cell phone. 75% of 15 to 17-year-olds have access to a cell phone. Teens who have cell phones are heavy users of online communication tools. 33% have used a cell phone to send a text message. Texting on cell phones is particularly common among those who already go online frequently and use other internet tools often. Between 1999 and 2004, the number of 8 to 18-year-olds who had access to a home computer, two or more computers, internet access, etc., grew pretty substantially. And if we look at the amount of media that children have access to between TV, videos, music, computers, playing video games, etc., there's a huge amount of their time. I don't know when they eat, sleep, or go to school, but they spend a lot of time with media. What we're seeing is that they actually multitask. They spend a lot of time with the same, a lot of the same time with multiple media experiences. The seventh grade seems to be when the wired teen population begins to surge. Junior high school is the tipping point. About 60% of sixth graders report getting online, 82% of seventh graders, and that goes up to 94% of 11th and 12th graders. Interesting part of this statistic is that only about 44% of sixth grade boys are online, whereas about 79% of sixth grade girls are online. Boys catch up, but girls once again are in the lead. Email is something that students use, but they generally use that as something to talk to old people. That would be us. Institutions or to send instructions to large groups. IM, instant messaging, is certainly a preferred communications medium, although here again, it's not just text. It's videos, it's links, it's pictures. It's using this information landscape in a very different way. In fact, if you look at what adults are more likely to do, they're more likely to bank online, use government sites, reserve travel, etc., than children or young people are likely to do that. All internet users are about as likely to shop online, get news, and use email. But as we heard earlier today, there's a whole cadre of experiences where young people, particularly 12 to 17-year-olds, are experiencing the media landscape in an entirely different way, even than their 18 to 28-year-old counterparts, let alone those of us, most of us in the room. So online games, instant messaging, downloading music, they're using the information landscape in a very different way than we are. As a consequence, students have very different expectations now about the availability of people and data, thanks to the vast stores of material on the internet and the ubiquity of email, instant messaging, and cell phones. The expectations are very different. So where is all the knowledge that we lost with information? If we think about education in the 20th century, information and knowledge was largely location dependent. You went to school because there was more information inside of school than there was outside of school, and you got access to it through lecture text and practice. Today, it's largely location independent. There's as much, and some would argue, more information outside of school and more available in more ways on more devices than it is available inside of school. Distribution has been flattened. Vast amounts of data and information are available, and they are or appear to be free. So as a consequence, anyone can author, anyone can publish, anyone can broadcast. And so if we think about a learning model with data information at the bottom leading up to insight, knowledge, and wisdom, the internet provides vast amounts of data and information. And how we access that information is very different. How many folks in the room use the I'm feeling lucky button? Why? Is that because as a generation we don't feel lucky? It's because our way of approaching information is very different from the way in which many young people see and access information. And it's not just how we get access to it, it's how it's organized, how it's arranged, how it's delivered is different as well. And it's available on multiple devices. In addition, there are entirely new communities that are evolving to create information, the whole open source, open educational resources communities. Communities are coming together to create new models for information design, information delivery, and information organization. And that's having an impact on schools, many of, or a number of whom, are seriously considering how to bring the digital resources into schools, either in conjunction with or in some heretofore rare cases, in place of their offline resources. And then, of course, you have Wikipedia, which is the community-based encyclopedia of all knowledge that the folks on around the world contribute to. And this happens to be the Wikipedia entry for textbook. And it says, this article or section is not written in the formal tone expected of an encyclopedia article. The article is missing citations and or footnotes. The neutrality of this article is disputed. The examples and perspectives in this article or section may not represent a worldwide view. So there's something going on here, right? Just having data and information available in a general context is not enough. In order to get insight, you need context and relevance. In order for knowledge, you need authority and suitability. And so we have the American Association of Publishers who have this on their website. And this is the process for creating a textbook. And so if you look at the, they have an entire process that takes into consideration educational research and advisory groups and parent groups and state legislatures and standards. And as you look at the process, after the first couple of steps, the rest of the process is all about delivering the physical book. And so you have a really interesting dichotomy. You have an organization that has an entire process for creating authoritative and suitable information focused on delivery, and you have folks who have gotten the delivery part down pat, struggling with how do you create a process for authoritative and suitable information. So the whole question of expertise, the whole question of what is accurate, reliable information is in flux. And as educators, we have to balance that conversation. What do we let into schools? What role do we as educators play in creating the new design of information? How do we re-architect what expertise is so that we can create the kind of positive information flow for students that we need? Because what we find is that as you move up the pyramid, the information becomes more valuable. But that its real value is when it's personal. And because our students have access to devices that enable them to get information in large part anytime, anywhere, when they want it and when what's of interest to them, if we miss that context in our schools, we're disenfranchising them intellectually almost from the outset. Because no job looks like high school, right? Generally, you don't sit in rows and have to change your task every 45 minutes and do it by yourself. And I mean, we heard a lot about this earlier today. If we think about the current metaphor in education, it's really a factory metaphor. Education is production. We have these long, flat buildings. We have consistent inputs. We have a consistent process. Curriculum is, some would argue, an assembly line that students go down. Time is the constant. Quality is the variable. And if you think about the words we use to describe education, if you think about the metaphor itself, the language, the context, it is this production metaphor. The vocabulary that we use focuses on mechanical, efficient, repetitive, standard, and passive. We generally stay away from words like imaginative, creative, various, divergent, and active. And so part of the challenge, I think, is what is the new metaphor? If we know that we're no longer producing students, how do we create a new metaphor? How do we create new language to talk about what we mean? Is it a laboratory where students are researchers and scientists building new knowledge, where they're self-directed, where they're driven by interest, where there's team participation and project focus, where they have responsibility for discovery and documentation, where the teacher is the collaborator, guiding, observing, contributing, supervising, where you have expert contributions from the outside? What does that mean for school buildings and the organizational structure? It needs to be flexible, robust infrastructure. You have to have available tools. You have to have support for ad hoc collaboration and information sharing. Or is the new metaphor an office, where you have a project-based emphasis, where you focus on both the process and the product, where collaboration and communication is really part of what we're talking about? The responsibility is to produce at the end of the day, where you do 360 evaluations, where you migrate students through various team roles, where they play different roles on different parts of the process, where you have multi-age grouping, where you do functional grouping that's focused on creation and dissolution of teams rather than static constructs, where the teacher perhaps is a team leader, supervising, managing, and directing, creating challenging and engaging environments, coordinating assessments and evaluations, where what a teacher is embodies a different job role or different skills. And what does that metaphor mean for a school building? We get virtual offices. You have flexible spacing. You still need a robust technology infrastructure and availability of wide tools and resources. But the language that we use to talk about these visions is critical, I think, and has implications for the kinds of conversations that we're able to have. Because you can see the computer age everywhere but in the productivity statistics. And this was Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Solow, and he was talking about the business community in the 1990s, because by the late 1990s, despite billions invested in computers, corporate productivity remained essentially flat. Automating existing business practices did not produce substantial increases in productivity. It was only when you created new business models and new business processes using the technology did productivity increase, and that spawned other new businesses and new business models. I mean, think about how we bank. Think about how we shop today. Think about how you get medical information. There's an entirely new models of commerce, finance, medicine interactions that have been created because of the advances of the technologies, both in terms of efficiency, but also in terms of effectiveness. So what does that mean for education? I think it means we need to look at re-engineering our processes and structures. How do we leverage technology to think differently about instructional delivery? How do we use data to drive our conversations about performance, about accountability, and about success? How do we have different conversations about management and organization that leverage what technology can do? And then how do we align the technology with the educational challenges and the organizational goals that we have? How do we reallocate resources to make that happen? And what assumptions do we need to question about the current way in which we're organized and in which we deliver educational services? Because nothing stops an organization faster than the people who believe that the way you worked yesterday is the best way to work tomorrow. If we think about how other professions have been transformed by using technology, medicine, for example, it used to be Marcus Welby, MD, right? You had a physician and a receptionist. They had a stethoscope and an x-ray. And the physician took histories, did an external exam, diagnosed, and prescribed. Today, house. Okay? Entirely new set of job roles, physician's assistants, PRNs, taking history, developing charts, medical technicians, physicians still there, but there's a whole cadre of people who have been established to be able to provide them with actionable information about patient status. Entirely new technologies allow not only external exams, but internal exams. Physicians are still there to diagnose and prescribe, but they have an entirely different infrastructure that supports their ability to do that. If we think about education, it's welcome back, Cotter. Right? We have a teacher, principal, and superintendent. We have a blackboard and chalk, textbooks overhead. The teacher has to plan, design, deliver, assess, evaluate, report. What is the new model? Are there new job roles we need to think about inside of our schools or inside of our districts? We have an entirely new technology infrastructure that's available to us. So what does that mean for being a teacher, for being a principal, or being a superintendent? If your vision is for a year, plant wheat. If your vision is for a decade, plant trees. If your vision is for a lifetime, plant people. There's no one alive today who remembers a different education system. If you think about the education system that we have today, it was architected as an industrial age system for an industrial age economy. When 80% of the people who came out of school went to manufacturing or other type of service line job, and 20% of the people went in to become captains of industry. And our system was designed and set up to do that. We now are in information age. We need an information age education system to enable us to remain competitive in an information age economy. But none of us and none of our parents have ever had to sit down and have the kind of conversation about the fundamentally what do we want schools to do. Because the conversation has always been implicit. We know what school's for, schools where you go to learn. Each one of us has been through that system. And yet what we're seeing today is that that system is not adequate. That system is not delivering for our students the kind of experiences that engage them, the kind of experiences that inspire them, the kind of experiences that are encouraging them to continue to engage in our democracy and in our economy in the ways that we used to. And so part of the challenge is that we have to have a different kind of conversation. We have to step back as communities and have a conversation about what is it we want schools to really do. We know, for the most part, that kids need to go somewhere 6 or 8 hours a day because their parents have to go to work. And so the challenge is, what do we do that's of value and interest in those 6 to 8 hours? When we have students who are expecting personal experiences with personal information and have devices that are able to for them to access that irrespective of whether they go to a place or not, we have to begin a different kind of dialogue. And this is not a dialogue, I don't think, that is a federal conversation. This is precisely the kind of conversation that needs to happen, where community members, where stakeholders invested in the local community sit down and say, what is it we really want to do? What's really important to us? Is it the social interaction we heard about earlier? Is it STEM? Is it accountability? Is it literacy? Is it workforce development? What are the things that we are really important to our community, and how do we ensure that our schools reflect that, and the experiences that we put in place, the organizational design that we put in place, enables that conversation to occur? And we realized in our office at the department that that conversation often doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because there's no common entry point for that dialogue. As a recovering geek, I know that the fastest way to be left alone at a cocktail party is to start talking about bandwidth or education reform, for that matter. And so part of the problem is that we have no common entry point. As communities, we don't have a history. We don't have an experience sitting down and designing a school system because it was always there for us. And so the common entry point is particularly important. There's no big picture. And so what we did was we created a big picture. We call it School 2.0. And it's a brainstorming tool to help communities sit down and figure out what's really important to them about the experiences they want students to be able to have, so that you can get all of the stakeholders, including students, at the table to argue, to talk, to vision about what a shared future looks like and what the role the education system has in leading you there. So that you can have experiences that are focused less on jargon and less on technology and less on the mechanics and more on the experiences. As a parent, what's really important? I want to be able to know how my son or daughter is doing. I want my child to be able to learn a language. I want, as an employer, I want my students that are coming out of high school to be able to be interested in the jobs that I've got available today. That's a different kind of conversation than we've had about school up until this point. And it leads us into a systemic planning and implementation conversation. If we recognize that technology plays a role in helping us to be more efficient and ideally more effective, then we have an opportunity to step back and say, what's important to us about how our schools operate? And then how can we leverage technology in a systemic way, linking backroom and classroom, using data to provide information, but using the flexibility of digital tools to personalize educational and delivery? When we have that kind of conversation with a shared community vision in line, we can reallocate resources. We can make decisions about what to do and what not to do in ways that, again, many of us have not had the need to have that conversation up until this point. So we put together this brainstorming tool. It's available at school2-0.org. I've actually got some copies if folks want to look at it. And we really wanted to use this as an opportunity to empower champions. Champions like you folks sitting here in the room today, because we know how difficult it's going to be for you to have a great day like this and to go out the door and try and explain to somebody back at the ranch what really happened. Because they're not here. Either by choice or by fiat. And so as a consequence, ideally we need to think of visual ways to get people invested in a different kind of conversation. So we've started with this. We're also developing some collaborative planning tools and other things that we hope will be available this summer to help, in particular, principals and technology directors have collaborative planning conversations about what they want to see go on in the schools that reflect the kind of community input that we hope these projects can generate. Because the future is not some place we're going to, but one we are creating. The paths to it are not found, but made, and the activity of making them changes both the maker and the destination. Thank you. I'm getting the high sign that I have a few minutes for questions or comments or... Yes, sir.
I'm just curious what the Department of Education is doing in the field of metrics for 21st century skills.
Part of the... We're actively involved in the conversation. We've certainly been working with Karen and the partnership along those lines. I think part of the challenge that we run up against is that the way our system is structured, those kinds of metrics are more often generated at the state or district level, and so our participation is more in terms of background support than it is actual substance. The Constitution actually kind of gets in our way, and if you want to look at it that way, when it comes to the ability to define metrics or to define specific benchmarks or standards for schools. So we're engaged in the conversation, but it's really a state-level conversation, and we're trying to facilitate. We're trying to do two things. One is to facilitate the top-down conversation through No Child Left Behind and the accountability structures, and we're also trying to facilitate a local conversation through School 2.0 and some of the other activities that we're doing, because we think they're complementary. There has to be a different way to have communities engage in a dialogue about what's important to them, and then that has to bubble up to and align with the standards conversations that are in
Do you see any places that the skills they can introduce into the NCLB?
Well, there is today an NCLB a technology literacy requirement for students in eighth grade. What that is been left up to the states to define. So it exists in statute at the moment. But again, we're kind of in an odd the way our system is structured, those kinds of specific requirements are the responsibility of the states. It's not really a federal role to define particular benchmarks or standards. I think there's certainly been a lot of conversation about continuum, everything from getting sort of nationwide consistency among state standards all the way up to folks who are once again advocating for national standards. But up until that conversation reaches some sort of resolution, the current system that we've got is sort of where we are. One more? Oh, yes, sir. Sorry.
We spoke a lot today about the role of teachers, principals, teachers, students. What can they do to shape 21st century education? What about the role of parents? We spoke a bunch about that. What can we do to educate them, since they hold the ultimate weapon? That is the vote. So what can be done to help them shape 21st century?
Again, I think, and this is where I do think that we're at a different crossroads in our history than we have been for at least a century, and that is the need to be able to have a community-based conversation of values about what we value as a community. And so I think the opportunity here to engage parents is really critical. It is in fact getting opportunities like this where you have a broad cross-section of people to come together. And then if you can either, A, create a shared vision about what you want to have for your community and how whether you define that at a school level, whether you define that at a district level, at a county level, or at a regional level, it seems to me that that the ability to then sit down with parent groups through PTA, but also engage parents directly through students, their parents are sort of a unique lot in the sense that they're customers on the one hand, they're taxpayers on the other, and they also have a unique connection to motivating students. I think the demographic shift that's happening with folks living longer means that in many communities, upwards of two-thirds of your communities actually don't have people. Most of your, about two-thirds of your communities aren't people who have kids in school right now. And actually, the biggest concern that I've seen is actually getting those folks who paid already. You know, I built schools when my kids were in school. I paid for, the additional services 20, 30, 10 years ago, and you're asking me to do it again. So I think it's engaging parents, but it's also engaging that broader community in a different kind of conversation about social contract, about what it is that we're trying to do as communities. What are the values that our education system promotes? Hard work and community participation, but also civic participation, democracy, etc. I think that's a different kind of conversation, and I'm not sure that we have the mechanisms anymore that we used to in order to do that because of the media landscape and everything else. I think a lot of the outlets for those kinds of community collaborations that used to exist through affinity groups or through religious organizations or others don't come together in the same way around some of these issues. And I think there's an opportunity to step back, particularly groups like this, where you do have a cross-cut across the community, to step back and say, how do we re-energize the affinity groups that exist in our community, including parents, into a different kind of conversation about what we all want to have, as opposed to seeing this as kind of a special interest motivation opportunity. Thanks very much. Thank you.